successes, agency challenges, and then the funding sources. I'm on page three now, and PERS provides retirement, death, and disability benefits for about 95% of all Oregon public employees. We've got about 210,000 active and inactive members. We cover about 870 public employers. And those public employers range in size from, you know, a cemetery district with a half-time employee to multiple employers with over 1,000 employees, like the university system, OHSU, of course, the state payroll system, and our large school districts and cities. We now pay benefits to about 106,000 retirees, injecting over $2.5 billion annually into the economy. Our average benefit for people who've retired in the last 10 years is about $22,500. We've got four major components now as a result of PERS reform. We operate the Tier 1 program, the Tier 2 program, and the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, also known as OPSERP, pension program. And then we've got a separate account-based individual account program, which we also refer to as the IAP. Beyond those four programs, we also administer a deferred compensation program known as the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and post-retirement health insurance health care benefit program. We've got about 19,000 people participating in the Savings Growth Plan, nearly $1 billion saved, and we cover about 50,000 retirees and dependents in our retiree health insurance plans. I think one of the things that, from a system standpoint, that has been a huge success has been the turnaround in the funding of this system following PERS reform. In early 2003, we had projected an unfunded actuarial liability of more than $17 billion, and we were only 65% funded. As a result of PERS reform, the investment performance and timely issuance of pension obligation bonds, and I understand you had Treasury here yesterday, and they spoke to several of those, we're now 104% funded, and our assets exceed our liabilities by $1.75 billion. We now have about $61 billion in the PERS fund, making us one of the largest public or private retirement funds in the nation. As you probably heard yesterday, we work with the Oregon Investment Council, who actually invests the fund assets on behalf of the trust, and you've heard about their outstanding performance. I think we've averaged over the last 4 years over a 15% annualized return. In my role as the executive director, I also serve on the Oregon Investment Council as a non-voting member, as a liaison to the PERS board, and we're currently engaged in joint meetings between the PERS board and the Oregon Investment Council on an asset, doing our asset liability study. So there's a lot of interaction between those two. From a funding standpoint, investments generated more than 85% of our revenues in 2005. Historically, about four out of every $5 that we bring in come off of investments. The remainder come from member and employer contributions. A little bit of information on our employer rates now for 2007-09. They're going to average about 15% before adjusting for side account offsets. Side accounts are where the pension obligation bond proceeds are deposited, and they'll be about 8.1% after adjusting. Member contribution rates are set in statute. They're at 6% of covered salary. You'll hear, of course, a lot in your budgeting process about the state rates. I believe the state blended rate is about 6.7%. The bond offset from the state's $2 billion pension obligation bond, which now has grown to a value of about $2.3 billion, is about 9.5% of payroll. And I believe the bond cost is somewhere in the 6.2% rate or so. So that bond, as we figure, has saved the state more than 3% of payroll right now. Again, a real timely issuance, caught the market right in terms of issuing the bond and if it had a really good return on it. Page six just shows you our membership by category. You'll note that we're now about equally Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 2 started January 1 of 1996, It's got a little bit different benefit structure to it, and obviously the majority of our retirements are in that Tier 1 population, and the majority of our liabilities are in that Tier 1 population. We're starting to see growth in the new plan, the Public Service Retirement Plan. I think the figure is somewhere around 8%, 8 to 10% turnover going on in the system as a whole. And we're working with our actuary. This is the first time we did a valuation for that plan to get a breakdown by agencies, local government, and school districts of the membership in OPSERP. And hopefully when we get back together with you later on this spring, we'll have that breakdown. You can see we're about a third. I think it's 27% of the members are in state agencies, 35 in local government, 38 in school districts. Page 7 is just a schematic organizational chart as well as responsibilities under our different divisions. You'll note that we've got a governing board. It's now a 5-member board, 3 from the private sector with no connection to PERS, 1 representative of members and 1 representative of employers. We've got the various divisions highlighted down below. You'll see the central administration division, of course, supports the board, does the central activities. Also, I have the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and the retiree health insurance reporting to me through that organization as well. Benefit payments is just what it is. That's where the primary action is in terms of paying out our benefits. We also do specialty services, air handling, death, divorce, and disability. And a major project, which we refer to as Strunk Eugene, is our adjustment process for about 44,000 benefit recipients as a result of 2 major court rulings where we're going back in and collecting overpayments. Fiscal services is the standard things that you'd expect in a fiscal service entity within a system like this. Major division, our information services division, major project going on there that I'll mention later on. customer service division, the people who handle the front end of the business workload, and then of course we've got a policy planning legislative analysis division that also handles our appeals and litigation coordination with our DOJ and outside counsel. A little bit of program history. We were established in 1946. The insurance programs were added in the late 50s. The Savings Growth Plan, which was actually created in 77, got transferred to PERS in 91. Tier 2 started in 96, and then, of course, the major reform of 2003, and I just bullet the 4 major features of that reform on page 4. In terms of continuation of the history and change, 2 major court decisions. I'm on page 9 here. March of 2005, and if I remember right, this decision kind of came in maybe when we were right at the end of our budget hearings last biennium, and that was a Supreme Court decision on the reform legislation where they overturned 2 of the reform provisions, one on an earnings crediting limitation requiring us instead to grant or to credit the assumed earnings rate, which is currently 8% each year. And the other was using the COLA freeze method to recover overpayments. Court said you can't use that. You've got other statutory authorities to recover the overpayment, and those are still available to you. However, the balance of the reform package, the updated actuarial factors, the earnings crediting restrictions, and the redirection of member contributions was upheld. And as a result of that, that's where we're seeing a significant change in the system and a significant improvement in our funded status. And then after the legislature had adjourned in August of 2005, the Supreme Court issued its decision in the City of Eugene case. And it ruled that the settlement agreement that the board had reached in that case and the reform legislation had basically resolved all the issues, and it mooted the appeal. And as a result of that, because under the settlement agreement, we go back in now and we're reallocating 1999 earnings to Tier 1 member accounts at 11.33 instead of 20%. You might ask, how can you do that 6-7 years later? This was a litigation that actually had started as soon as the board had made that crediting decision. So in essence, the litigation had kind of tolled the bell on that, and so when the court ruled as it did, we then entered in, or we then triggered the settlement agreement. And then here, I think it was around December 12 of this year, we got the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals decision in the Robertson case, which upheld dismissal of the federal law challenges to the 2003 reform legislation. So here we are about 3 years after the reform bills had passed, and we now know what kind of system we're going to be administering long term. You know, we've added two new programs. The PERS reform bottom line was that we've stabilized the liabilities and improved the cost predictability of the system. And the rulings in Strunk and Eugene and Robertson now provide the program certainty that we need to move forward and focus on the continuous improvements in our operations and our processes required to provide the services that we now and products that we now deliver in our most cost-effective and efficient manner. Transactions on page 11, one of the major things that we changed was our method of employer reporting. We now have gone to 100% electronic reporting, and it's done on a payroll basis. So, you know, 870 employers reporting. They're reporting in about 1,000 reports per month, and those reports at the member level are about 230,000 records per month, so you can see a tremendous amount of member records coming in. We used to have the majority of the employers reporting on an annual basis. The idea here is get the data in, get it reconciled over the course of the year, continue to keep it reconciled so you're not having to deal with data uncertainties 30 years later when you're retiring someone. We've moved a lot of the work up to the front end of the process, but we truly believe that that's an investment that's going to pay off over time. We're now, from a member statement standpoint, we've got three different statements that we issue. We issue the Tier 1, Tier 2, individual account program, and the pension program. You get a flavor there for how many we issue. From a transaction standpoint, for the at the member level, this gives you an idea of the retirements that we processed in 2006. We now also retire people out of the individual account program. And it looks like about half of the folks that retired in 2006 also retired out of the individual account. Some of them may be holding off, and then they'll trigger that down the road here. We've got no one retired yet out of the OPSERP pension program. It's only been in existence for 2.5 years, but I believe we've had some people inquire about it because they might have come in, start work when they were 65 years old, and 2 years later they're just going to retire out of that program. You'll see when we process withdrawals now, we do withdrawals both out of Tier 1, Tier 2, and out of the individual account program. Purchases are only Tier 1, Tier 2. There's no opportunity to make purchases of waiting time or military time or teaching in another state in the OPSERP program. And then, of course, the inevitables. We process a number of deaths. We process a number of divorces. And we do have, I think, about 4,000 members that have received disability retirements over the years, and we review those cases on a regular basis as well. In terms of our member employer customer service, we just have some statistics here, and we're working hard to try to deliver service in the most cost efficient manner possible, and we're like everyone else. We certainly recognize that the cheapest way is to get people provide what people need on your website so they can access it at their convenience and do everything they can there. The next cheapest is provide it through telephone contact. And then, of course, the more expensive is the face-to-face presentations, and we do a lot of that through group presentations now. We do provide some form turn-in days. We're looking at how can we improve the application assistance, because we're like any other agency that processes applications, permits, or anything. We've discovered that the better job our members do in completing the application and getting all the information that we need, the easier it is for us to process that application. In terms of performance successes, I want to start at the top, and I would be remiss if I didn't recognize the efforts of the legislature, the governor, the stakeholders, the board, the OIC, and indeed the agency, and the contributions in terms of implementation of PERS reform and what is really being considered around the nation as a successful reform of a public retirement system. And then, of course, we've spent a significant amount of time in providing support to our new board and bringing new discipline to the system, developing new conservative earnings crediting and reserving practices, reducing amortization periods. And then we worked for about a 14-month period to financially model the system and adopt new actuarial methods to improve the transparency and accountability of the system. We're now doing everything on a fair market value basis, and our numbers are going to match up with the numbers you're going to hear from other entities. Major effort was a remediation and restructuring of the individual account program to correct account balances, simplify the earnings crediting, and the expense administration, allow for prior period adjustments, and enhance our processing. That's a key component of reform, and it needed to be restructured in order to work right for the members and employers. We streamlined and improved our employer reporting through technology enhancements. We reduced employer accounts receivable from 82 employers owing over $2.1 million to 14 owing $250,000. We contact them on a regular basis. We're doing the same on the member accounts receivable. We implemented mandatory electronic fund transfers for all employer contributions, which helped streamline our internal processes and reduce some control risks. We completed the Strunk Eugene account balance adjustments for about 200,000 active and dormant members, developed this comprehensive plan to recover from about 44,000 benefit recipients. That's about a third of our retirees that we're reaching out and touching under that program. Again, in an effort to improve services by enhancing our web capabilities, we updated our benefit estimate calculator. We developed some web-based presentations on both the benefit package and how to complete forms, installed a new call center telephone system, cut our abandonment rate in half. We're now handling somewhere around 600 to 800 phone calls at the call center a day. Incorporated a new Medicare drug benefit into our insurance program, reducing premiums by about $30 a month for our Medicare eligible participants. And I've worked hard to increase both the enrollment, both the participation and the contributions to the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. This is a supplemental savings program that is going to become a more and more important component of people's retirement, because PERS reform is not going to push you out at 100% of your salary. You're going to have to make up the gap with other resources. We've got a major IT system conversion program underway, completed phase one of that, and that's the House Bill 2020 implementation. We're now moving into the conversion. We call it it's titled RCP here. That's the RIMS conversion project. That project remains on budget. We have rebaselined the schedule to ensure that it's aligned with these other projects. The Strunk Eugene processing that we do, we have to do that in RIMS because these are accounts that were closed out in RIMS, and we don't want to transfer them into J Clarity, into the new system, into J Clarity. We've also changed some of the scheduling of the deliverables in order to allow us to use that functionality earlier in the project phase. I believe we're scheduled to complete this project in November of 2009. And then, of course, because of the document handling that we're doing, we're trying to move as much as we can to electronic images, and we use what we call what's known as a FileNet system that allows us to image those documents and move them out into the work processes. And I think those are key to the operational changes and process improvements that we're focusing on over the next biennium. Challenges. A big challenge for us is about a third of our 28% of our members are eligible to retire, about 50,000 people. And the question is, are they going to come out 5 to 6,000 a year, or are they going to come out 10 to 15,000 a year? We don't see anything on the horizon that's going to drive, we don't have any reform trigger dates or anything that's going to force people to retire, but that's a personal decision, and, you know, you can see from this graph, we're just like anyone else. We've got a huge segment of baby boomers that are moving through the system. And what we discovered, of course, is as people get close to retirement, they increase their demand on our services, and that's one of the challenges we face. The workload associated with the new programs, you know, again, we now administer four major retirement programs. We pay two benefits. We pay two withdrawal benefits. We're maintaining at least two accounts for each member. We've got currently we're issuing two annual statements to them. These are separate processes. They need to be closely coordinated, and wherever possible, they need to be integrated. And one of the things that we're hoping is that by 2008, with the system changes, we'll be able to issue one member statement that covers all their accounts. Ongoing litigation, we believe that the major litigation is behind us, but we do have several lawsuits challenging the Strunk-Eugene recovery, and we just want to make sure people are aware that, you know, we're running north, but the court could tell us you got to start running south. And so part of what we did in that project was make sure that we could restructure the work and undo it if the court directs us to. Simultaneous staffing of both these special projects, the Strunk-Eugene, the RIMS conversion project, IEP remediation, and day-to-day operations certainly has stretched our subject matter experts thin. And then our world of operating with two different IT systems and having to do the bridging between those systems and the data migration, that's a fact of life. We didn't want to do something where we stayed in one system and then added the new one. We wanted to take advantage of that functionality, and we've done that. And I'll close with just our funding source by programs. I'd point out that we're another fund-funded agency, administrative costs funded primarily by investment earnings. As a percent of the total fund, we're running somewhere right now around 6.5 basis points in terms of the administrative costs. You'll see we do have some different funding sources by program. Primarily, the difference with the individual account program, that's funded only by investment earnings on member accounts, whereas our administrative costs for our pension programs come from all of our accounts. Retiree health insurance are funded by premium subsidies, and the Oregon Savings Growth Plan is funded by a charge on each account, again, about 8 basis points. One I don't have on here, Social Security, which is a program that we do the coordination with, is funded by a charge to employers equal to 50 cents per employee for each participating employer. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've completed the overview that we've got here. We certainly appreciate the interest of the committee in our activities. We're trying to get around to each of the members and go through our PERS by the numbers document and any questions that they've got, and at this stage I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Clary. Any questions? Got a couple. There's any comments?
Mr. Chair, if I may add one comment. I wanted to reemphasize something. In the PERS reform legislation, you didn't have it bulleted, but I think one of the keys, and Mr. Clary talked about it a bit later, was the change in the composition of the board. That the change in the composition of the board has strengthen the implementation of the PERS, the other PERS reform legislation that dealt with benefits. That brought a far more disciplined approach to the board with the business background and the requirement of experience in pension administration and employee benefits on the board. I believe that has been a value to PERS in its administrative activities also.
Thank you. Representative Crumble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, Paul, and I think you can answer them fairly quickly, but if not, then feel free to send us a note on it. The first one is defining active on page 6. You talk about active and inactive, and can you kind of give us a clue of what those are? And then the second question is in the RIM system and J-Clarity conversion, are we at a point now in that conversion that most of the workarounds that were having to be done before have been able to be reduced?
Mr. Chair, to the Representative Crumble, to the first question, active are currently employed. Inactive are vested members that aren't currently employed by a cover employer. And to the second question, in terms of the J-Clarity functionality, the major functionality that's online now is in the employer reporting area. The workarounds have occurred more in the benefit payment division area. We certainly have automated a lot of those. We don't do pencil to paper. We call it a manual process, but it's manual because it's not just using the single system to do it. We're doing a lot of work with other desktop tools. But we've added some huge quality controls to that process, and I'll be happy to talk some more with you when we get around and meet you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clary, you should do this presentation to the Oregonian so they understand what's going on. I appreciate I had two questions. Number one is the lawsuits, and specifically the Sprunk and Eugene, what's the potential financial impact of that? And then my second question, it is a question. Just anecdotally, in my district, I have a lot of people who have expressed frustration, and you've mentioned this as a challenge, just that they haven't been able to get perhaps what you might view as unrealistic, but individual counseling. Obviously, there's enormous decisions on people's lives, and there's a lot of frustration for members about getting the counseling so that they can make wise decisions. Right. And I understand it's cheaper to do website and phone, but in terms of overall quality. So what are some of the, if you could just talk about some of the factors affecting that, and then what can be done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, to your first question, the lawsuits right now are focused on the recovery of about $800 million from retirees and other benefit recipients. About $650 million of that hasn't gone out the door yet. That's just recovered through reducing future benefits. The other $150 is actually recouping overpayments. To your other question, application assistance is something that we're focusing on. One of the things that we're doing with our group presentations now is allowing some time at the end of that to help people in terms of questions on the forms themselves. And we're looking at reinstituting something that we used in the past, which we called a turn-in forms day. Because you're right, what they really want to know, they just want to validate that form. And so I think when we come back, we'll have some more to report on what we're going to put in place there.
Okay. Follow up?
Quickly.
So previously, didn't people have the ability to be kind of individual? They would meet with counselors kind of on an individual basis. Is that no longer? Is that just not possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, in cases of divorces and other specialty services, we still provide that. We do a lot of that now, like you say, over the phone, and we're looking at ways to enhance that application assistance. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Paul, I have a question.
Well, yeah, I do.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clary, there was a piece in here that talked about cutting your call abandonment rate in
half.
And I assume that self-explanatory, just calls that you just never follow up on, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I'm sorry for using that term. What that means is people who have said, I've waited 3 minutes, I'm hanging up.
Thank you.
And so we've cut that from 15% down to 7%. We'd like to cut it down to 4%, but it's somewhat a function of how we staff the system and how we triage the calls. And we try to direct people into our automatic call responses as well if they've got standardized questions. But we'll talk some more about that when we get in.
I have maybe a couple questions, but one of them, it's the only one I'll ask right now. And I don't know that I expect that you have this information, but I would hope to ask the question that we may get it when you come back before us. And that is if you could have some figures on the percent of the improvement in the funding from 65 underfunded mm-hmm. to 104 overfunded,
right.
The percent that is due to the factors that you have listed here, the improving market situation and the... reform legislation or reform movements that were present. So.
Mr. Chair, we filled that hole with about a third from the changes in the plan from reform, about a third with investment performance beyond 8%, and about a third with the pension obligation bonds. So those it's about equally from each of those, about 5 to 6 million, billion from each.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Real quickly.
Just one quick question. Mr. Cleary, what portion of the PERS assets are what portion of the PERS assets, you said 85% of the income is coming from your assets appreciation. What part of that is realized and what part is unrealized? And of the unrealized part, what do you do to try to ensure to stabilize that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Woods, we operate on a change in net asset value, and whether that change is up or down, and so we're recognizing the total change in the net asset value of the fund, and that's how the actuary operates as well. I'd be happy to get together with Treasury staff and come around and talk some more with you if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, members, this system operates differently from a lot of them in that the administration of the system resides with the Public Employees Retirement System. The administration of the investments resides with Treasury. They work together quite closely with the Public Employees Retirement System and its board for that very reason on cash flow needs and the like, and then the Investment Council works, and we can discuss that when the Treasury comes in again, on its investment policies, so that realized and unrealized has a longer timeline of achievement quite often than the realized income on the system. But they work quite closely together so that you're not jeopardized as far as cash flow and the like with that, and also with earnings crediting decisions.
Yeah.
Just wanted to make that point, that there is a clear bifurcation of responsibilities for the investments versus the administration of the system.
Mr. Chair, and as Dallas indicated, we certainly are interrelated. Decisions that the board makes on reserving and earnings crediting can affect the stability and performance of the fund. The asset allocations can affect the performance as well.
Okay. Thank you. And I assume you're happy that nobody asked questions that he couldn't answer. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next up, the Department of Administrative Services, Director Lindsay Ball, and bringing along with him Kay Erickson, I guess, who doesn't want to have anything to say but is here in case needed. Maybe I'm a little presumptuous, Kay. Maybe you do want to have something to say, in which case we'll listen.
I am fine.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Ball. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, Chair Jensen. Thank you. My name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. Kay Erickson is the analyst from DAS who is assigned to this agency, seated to my left. And also in the audience, I want to point out Deputy Director Chris Kautz here today with us as well. I think, Chair Jensen, the best place for me to start is simply to talk a little bit about what's happened the last year in the Department of Administrative Services so that maybe the committee can kind of get a feel for some of the things that have taken place and some of the changes that have occurred. I'd like to say that the executive leadership team, I have found the executive leadership team in the agency is a team that is truly looking at how they can provide a service to our state government. They are looking at creating solutions collectively and collaboratively across lines. They're mindful of the statewide impacts that their decisions may have and policies that they put in place may have on agency administration as well as business in the state of Oregon. And I think you're going to find that next week when we come in for our 2 weeks of ways and means presentations, you're going to find that the executive leadership team of the agency has a sincere desire to create trust and confidence in our state government. And they want to create that trust and confidence through the service delivery of our responsibilities that are assigned to us in statute. And the mission of the agency, Chair and members of the committee, is to lead the pursuit of excellence in state government. Now, the purpose of the Department of Administrative Services under ORS 184305 is to provide the following: government infrastructure services that can best be provided centrally, rules for compliance with statewide policy and performance reviews, leadership in implementing a statewide performance measurement program, which is very important in this legislative session as it has been in past. State employee workforce development and training. As everyone knows, we are changing the workforce in state government as the baby boomers start aging out and go into retirement. There is a challenge as to how we fill the void behind them. Personnel systems that promote fair, responsive, and cost-effective human resource management, objective, credible management information and analysis of statewide issues for policymakers, statewide financial administrative systems, and statewide information systems and networks to facilitate reliable exchange of information and applied technology. On page 3, you'll see the organizational chart of the agency from the director's office down to the other program areas. I do want to make note, it doesn't show in this chart, but there is an Office of Economic Analysis in the director's office, and many of you in Ways and Means key off of that office's work as you deliberate the budgets here in the near future. Major accomplishments. We completed the 6-year strategic plan for the agency, and I'd like for everyone to note that is the first strategic plan for the Department of Administrative Services. I've been involved with several strategic planning processes and the resulting documents. I would say this is one of the better products after my experience with other strategic plans. We also began involving our stakeholders in our operations. State agencies are our main customers, and so we went to them to ask them about how they want to be charged for different services that we provide. What would be the assessment rates that would be imposed upon them for the services that they requested? And so they are a direct participant in the budgeting and the policy formation under current protocols with the Department of Administrative Services. We moved the computing and network infrastructure, which is known as Scenic, We moved it from project status to operational status, and oftentimes what you will hear it referred to today as the state data center, as the project starts to phase into the operational side. We reorganized the Information Resources Management Division and created the Enterprise Strategic Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division, which saved the state $2.9 million, and we'll touch on that in a little bit too. We promoted fiscal integrity within the department. All program areas in the department instituted new budget reviews and decision-making tools to ensure that all programs operate within budget. The development of the leadership team, I praised them at the start of the presentation, and we continue to develop a leadership team that recognizes success gained by collaborating and problem-solving together. We also implemented the Safety and Wellness Leadership Initiative across agencies in the state government. And what we were noticing that on workers' comp issues, the claims are somewhat consistent, but the costs continue to rise. We felt that the claims are a manageable part of state government if we start taking a renewed look at how we employ safety measures in state government, and also with that, how we take care of ourselves in state government as individuals. And so we started asking the question, can we create some voluntary wellness initiatives in the state where employees would be more mindful of their health and well-being? We advanced the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network by carrying forward administration and planning efforts of this statewide project, including business case and budget development. That is an ongoing project that I think you will see in the future to be well-managed. The strategic plan was developed to accomplish the mission of DAS. The plan guides our work through 2011. The plan includes four major goals and strategies, and to ensure that the programs are linked to the strategic plan, we ask that each of the program areas write a business plan within the Department of Administrative Services that links to the strategic plan, which also links back into performance measures. So we have a continuous loop of connectivity with that. The first goal is excellent customer service, foster excellent customer relations, deliver timely and accurate information, effective policies with clear direction. As I mentioned earlier, we do engage the agency directors and their staff in deliberating over those policies and directions. Efficient and effective government infrastructure, ensure appropriate oversight and cost containment, and optimize performance. Goal four is adaptable government for future generations, leading efforts to define and implement statewide visions, ensure state government meets workforce needs, protect the state's information assets and systems, advance sustainable business practices in government. As we move into performance measures on page 11, there are 16 key performance measures in the Department of Administrative Services, 8 of which are new. I will remind everyone, some of you were on the audit committee during the interim, but all the performance measures have went through the process of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee as well as the LFO process. The first one up, key performance measure 1, is customer service. It's found on page 11 and 12. I want to point out that in 2006, when we conducted the survey, we got about a 70% approval rating for good or excellent service by state agencies. The leadership team in the department does not feel that's adequate. We have set a target of 90%. We will be sending a customer service survey out towards the end of this month, hoping to get it all back with the tabulated results by mid-March. I'm anxious to see if we've improved. I think probably we will see an improvement there. Forecast reliability is the Office of Economic Analysis accurately depicting what the revenue forecasts are. 3 is financial management, number of years out of the last 5 that the State Controller's Division wins the Government Financial Officers Association Certificate of Achievement. And you'll note that the 5 is actually a 5-starred system that they use of awarding points. we've been consistent in picking up the rating of number 5. Number 4 is state workforce turnover. Annual turnover rate for the state workforce. Number 5 is racial ethnic diversity in state workforce as percentage of the total civilian labor force. Number 6 is a new measure that is a statewide fleet administration evaluated as affected by independent party. Number 7 is rent costs, uniform rent costs per square foot as a percent of market, private market in the local area. Number 8 is a new measurement, percent of state's major IT projects with a budget or schedule variance of 5%, of a plus 5%, to be reported in the quarterly major IT project portfolio report for which a migration plan is submitted in response to a DAS requirement. Number 9 is e-government, percent of agency financial transactions that have been automated. Number 10 is a new measurement, percentage of actions identified in House Bill 3145 or the resulting Enterprise Security Office Strategic Plan completed on time. In the last session, there was a lot of emphasis placed on security, enterprise security for our IT. I think we're making some progress in that area to ensure security for the state's information. Number 11, which is new, is the percentage of identified business risk that is remediated for security. Number 12 is the estimated savings resulting from price agreement pricing compared to prices that would be paid without the benefit of a price agreement. Number 13 is the annual number of workers' comp, liability, property, and total claims per 100 FTE. Again, that comes back to the safety and wellness initiative that we were implementing. Number 14 is a new measure, a percentage reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Number 15 is also a new measure, is a percent of healthcare policy stakeholders who rate the usefulness, objectivity, and reliability of healthcare data provided by the Office of Health Policy and Research as good or excellent, similar to our customer survey performance. And the last one, number 16, is a percentage of time systems are available at the state data center. And we've set a goal of 99.9%. Department-wide priorities, they are listed. Number 1 is the highest. And for the next, from page 22, 23, 24, and 25, that is in descending order of priority. I won't go through those specifically one by one. Those are available to you for your review. Department-wide priorities, as requested, the administration was set aside in a separate sheet for the committee to look at as well. I won't go through that line by line. I'll let you review that. Budget drivers. The governor's budget agenda was built upon a strong economy, quality environment, and improving access to affordable health care, and that is the governor's agenda associated with this budget, not the statewide budget. We received input from stakeholders. Again, we went out, talked to the agencies. What is it you want in the way of service? What's the cost going to be associated with that? Ballot Measure 37, high volume of claims. DAS is the initial recipient of claims made against the state. I do want to point out that the volume of claims between November 1 and December 4th of 2006 exceeded the volume from the previous 2 years. We have a tremendous backlog of processing to do with associated with Measure 37. Moving to page 28, need to invest in our infrastructure. The new human resource information system that is in our budget is a request by agencies, and we have also partnered with the Oregon Department of Transportation on a project where they are overhauling their internal system. We came for GLCIMT and delivered this information and the proposed project to them as well in the November GLCIMT meeting. This allows us to take a look at how we could take a small state agency project that would be under the umbrella of an enterprise, work some of the bugs out at the lower level, move that into an enterprise project statewide to satisfy the needs of human resource demands across the state. Continued investment in public employees benefit board vision with the online system where people through PEB.benefit can access access PEB, public employees benefit board, electronically rather than going through the mail. Say we have saved a lot of money by accomplishing that. Information Resources Management Division reorganization. We aligned the agency to meet the needs of today's needs rather than the late 80s or 90s. Streamlined the help desk application services and publishing and distribution moved to other divisions within DAS. The project management office was abolished, and all those things relate to the savings I mentioned earlier. We created the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division that focuses on policy, planning of IT, and strategy for the state. Revenue sources. In our budget, general fund makes up 2.1% of our budget. Other funds is 97.5%. Lottery funds is 0.4%. We pick up our budget through several through various means, assessments, which comes from other state agencies, fund some or all of every DAS agency's operations, customer expectations. This comes from the agencies. Value for dollar sent to DAS. Our challenge is to demonstrate and communicate how these funds help agencies meet their program goals. And once again, this links back to our time and energy that we put forth to ask the agency directors what it is they wanted in the way of service. And it also loops back to that customer service survey that we've done. Fees. Source is primarily other state agencies for direct services such as motor pools, building space, parking, payroll, phones, risk management, and others. On page 31, you'll see a pie chart of our fund types that are broken out. And I do please note that this agency has a large budget compared to the number of FTEs associated with it. A lot of those dollars are pass-through dollars or debt service that are in this budget, and it doesn't really reflect the accurate picture of what the budget is in relation to the staffing levels if you look at this budget compared to some other agencies' budgets. As a central administrative agency, we have a lot of lots of dollars in our budget. Major expenditure categories. Broken down in debt service, personal services, services and supplies, capital outlay, and special payments. On page 33, there's a pie chart of all fund types by division, office. That's broken down into all the program areas within DAS. I do want to mention, on the next three slides, you'll see pass-through funds. I think this gets to my point about the enlarged budget of DAS compared to the staff that we have. We pass through state agency mass transit assessments, state central government service charges, Oregon Liquor Control Commission revenue sharing to the cities, cigarette tax to the cities, amusement device tax to counties, U.S. Forest Service sale proceeds to counties, federal mineral lease proceeds to counties, land sales proceeds to counties, U.S. Taylor grazing fees to counties, federal flood control proceeds to counties, Oregon lottery proceeds to counties, Education Stability Fund, county fair account, and other entities. Pass-through funds also go in conjunction with the tobacco settlement account funds, lottery bond proceeds, and now we're getting into some of those large amounts of dollars in the millions. Oregon Opportunity Fund, Lottery Bond Debt Service, Pension Fund Bonds and Debt Service, and Oregon Appropriation Bonds Debt Service. That jacks that budget up much higher compared to other agencies and state government. Quality improvements. Increased use of direct deposit, as much as 30% savings over processing a warrant. Use of alternative fuels for state fleet, projected savings $250,000 for 05-07. Strategic sourcing through Smart Buy Initiative. New contract for digital print commitment, print equipment, saving $65,000 a month. Improved rent projections will allow 2007-09 uniform rents to stay at the current rate of $132. Implementation of PEBS.benefits, which is the electronic version rather than paper and mail. Emailing benefit information to PEB members has reduced printing and mailing by 50%. PEB incentives for encouraging generic and lower-cost drugs has increased members' use of low-cost alternatives from 54.7% in 2005 to 63.5% in the first half of 2006, which is a noticeable change. E-government transactions for 2005 grew by 30% over 2004. Again, that's a savings. Each transaction at current volume represents savings cost avoidance of nearly $5 per transaction. Reorganization of IRMD results in savings of $2.9 million in the 07-09 package or budget. Purchase packages of internet advertising for statewide recruitment, savings of $105,000. Recruitments moving away from print media to online advertising, which is where most of the recruits and applicants today are moving towards to look for employment. We increased our exposure and saved $227,000. We have two items in proposed legislation, inmate injury program and the cleanup of lottery distribution language, technical changes, nothing really substantive. Future directions. We continue to evaluate statewide administrative organizations and systems to maximize the value of government service to the public. Through recruitment, statewide policy review, performance measures, deferred maintenance, and facilities management and consolidation of IT enterprise. And we continue to drive our strategic plan and its four goals within the agency. The policy option packages are listed on 42, 43, 44. For your review, we will get into those in depth as we give the program overview starting next Monday. And you also have on page 45 and page 46 the 2% efficiencies noted in order from the least to the most important from top to bottom. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Ball, we're going to ask members if they have questions to jot them down and keep them since you will be back in front of the committee next Monday. And that should be soon enough that the importance of our questions won't kind of go away. I have one question, however, that may require a little bit of maybe just simplification for me. On the chart about major expenditure categories on page 32, a question, if you have this broken down or if I could get it broken down by fund type.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, almost all of this agency's expenditures are other funds because yes. Their source is not general fund. Of course, because they charge other agencies, the revenues coming into them are classified as other funds because they're charges for services and the like. However, the funding source that the agency who's paying them could be general fund, federal funds, or also other funds like a DCBS would fee for service type of agency. Overall, we just as a rule of thumb, we estimate that the other funds within DAS that come from other agencies, roughly 30 to 35%, might be general fund. But it's very difficult to get an exact handle on that.
I understand, but I'm looking for an exact handle on by fund type.
As to the revenues or the expenditures?
The expenditures.
Mostly other funds.
Well, yeah, I know they're all mostly other funds, since everything else is minimal on that. But whatever we can do on that, Lindsay, we're into the next people's time, and I appreciate you kind of help catch me up. So,
Mr. Chair, we will try to do our best to put something together that we'll work with Mr. Wyan to see if we can't come up with a reasonable process.
Yeah. And you can also work with me explaining why my question is irrelevant. But
well, no, I think your question is fairly relevant because it on the surface, when you take a look at the agency, when you see such a large other fund, it just begs the question, where does the money come from?
Yes.
And as it's budgeted, we would have to go back to each individual agency and identify their funding source, which their funding sources are oftentimes multiple sources too.
Yes. Thank you very much. We'll see you bright and early next Monday. Next, and I'm sorry, but we kind of want to keep this, and since they are coming back right away, we should be able to kind of hold the question. Next up for us is the Department of Revenue. We have Elizabeth Harchenko. I hope I'm correct on my pronunciation on that, Elizabeth. And good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. Good morning. Dallas is passing out some information for you. I am going to keep this extremely high level. We'll have a lot more detail for you when we come and visit with you when we're scheduled. But I'd like to, in the interest of your time commitments, just do some very touch on some very high level but important core items for the department. Our job that we've been given by the legislature in pieces and parts over the years is to make your tax systems work. And so we are what I would call core governmental infrastructure. We administer income taxes, tobacco taxes. We support the property tax system at the local level. But it's really, this is all about the funding streams that support education, public safety, human services. It's really important to us, because of the nature of the work that we do, that we have some clear core values in the organization. People trust us with confidential financial information that they wouldn't give their neighbors. We have a lot of high volume activity, especially in the individual income tax area, and so operations and continuing to improve those operations and striving for excellence is very, very important to us. Also, managing the dollars that we receive, both that we collect and that you give us as resources to administer your programs, are important to us, and how we interact internally and externally are very, very important, and those are things that we talk to our staff about consistently. We have an agency vision and a business plan, and I'll go into the business plan in much more detail when we come back. But our vision is about where we want to be, what we want to be like as an organization, how we want to function. So we have three areas of emphasis: the work environment, and that's about our staff, how we do the work internally within the organization, knowing why we do it and taking pride in it. The tax administration piece, which is our core function, and the principles that we apply there, that it's important for, particularly in the income tax area, which is over 90% of the general fund, and which depends on taxpayers doing the right thing timely and accurately, that we emphasize education and assistance to taxpayers who are trying to meet their commitments, and then use our enforcement tools appropriately. Again, reflecting our values of honesty, trust, and respect, good quality service, and partnerships with local government in the property tax area. And then, again, continuing to improve our operations. You have a high-level organization chart on page 5. This chart hasn't changed over the last 8 to 10 years. The organizational structure is pretty much the way you see it. The director's office includes myself, the deputy, our internal audit, legislative liaison, and communications functions. going clockwise around the circle. Our personal tax and compliance division is primarily responsible for the individual income tax. The property tax division works with local government to make sure that that very important revenue stream for local government is functioning well. Our business division deals with business taxpayers, and so it's responsible for withholding the corporate income tax, the inheritance tax, our tobacco taxes, and business collections. And then our administrative services division is our core internal support, information technology, human resources, our processing center, and our finance and accounting group. We do have our main offices here in Salem, and we have field and satellite offices throughout the state. As I mentioned when I talked about our agency vision, we have, as a business philosophy, adopted what we call the balanced approach to tax administration. We have about 1,700,000 individual income tax returns that we expect will be coming in. We have about 100,000 employers. And so in an initial instance, what we want to do is make sure that they know what they need to know and have the tools they need in order to meet their tax obligations from the beginning. The more people that understand it and do it correctly, the fewer we have to worry about on the back end of the process. But to the extent that we need to use enforcement tools, we try and make sure that we're using the tools that you give us wisely, judiciously, and appropriately. So we do a lot in the front end. Our website, our tax booklets, information circulars, working with the media on important things that when deadlines are coming up that people need to know about. We have a small call center where we answer taxpayer telephone calls. We have email boxes that people can send questions about their taxes to us for response. We have a web application for people to track where their refund is during the processing season. And we also get out in community, especially talking with small business about how they can best meet the obligations that they have under the tax laws. And then when we need to use, as I said, when we need to use our enforcement tools to collect the taxes that are owed, we do that. So we use that balance, education assistance, and enforcement through all of our tax administration efforts. The key issues for our budget this year that we'll talk to you again in more depth about when we come back are really are focused around the expectations that taxpayers have that they should be able to interact with their government in the same way that they interact with any other organization. And so we see more and more expectations of people wanting to be able to deal with tax issues online and any time of the day. And so we are focused on maximizing the amount of electronic filing that we get. It makes us more efficient and taxpayers more efficient. We have done a lot of work in the tobacco tax arena, cigarette tax and other tobacco products taxes. And the funding source for that has a sunset as of the end of this calendar year. So that's an issue that we'll be discussing with you further. Another issue that I'm sure that you're well aware of is that many counties are facing a significant loss of revenue due to some changes at the federal level. And those loss of that revenue can affect their ability to perform their obligations under the property tax system. And so we're very concerned about that and working with them to try to identify how we can be of assistance and what needs may shift to the department as a result. So we're working on continuing to improve our use of technology. We'll have a package we'll want to talk to you about to start a kick off a business strategy that we've adopted to really move to a paperless work environment as much as possible over the next 6 years. We've got some issues around refundable income tax credits and the higher level of work that they need in order to be sure that they're going out to people who are eligible for them. And we're continuing to work on electronic filing. A couple of other challenges we have, and I think Lindsay mentioned this just a little bit before, is that The workforce is aging, and so we are concerned about recruiting and retaining high-quality talent, especially in our high-level technical staff levels, auditing and people with computer skills. And then continuing to look at, in the property tax arena, because of the work we do for the counties, new kinds of businesses that are being developed in response to sustainability initiatives. Wind farms particularly have been a real interesting issue for us as a valuation challenge. So there's a lot of interesting things going on in our business. Our business plan, I've given you on page 9 just a little overview of that. We have a 4-year business plan that we refresh every 2. It serves as a base for planning for our development of our budget request. Keeps us kind of on track, moving towards our vision. It's focused on how we improve the core work that we're doing, what we need to change, realign, restructure in order to continue to achieve higher levels of performance. So that's been sort of our guide and that we use. And what I've got on page 9 are just a few of the things that we've accomplished during this biennium that we had put in our business plan. We had three policy option packages that were approved in the 05 session. And we are on track or have already achieved the revenue commitments that we made for those policy option packages. We had been working for about 3 years on rewriting a couple of major income tax processing systems that we use to process the individual income tax returns when they come in and keep track of taxpayers. And we put those online over the last year. We've continued to reduce the cost of processing income tax returns. We take advantage of technology advances that are developed in other states, as well as developing some of our own. And there's a process that's called 2D barcoding that we've been using on individual income tax returns for a while, and we've now moved those to the corporate tax returns so that we can eliminate having to do any kind of manual data entry. We can just use a little laser, kind of like they do in the grocery store, and all of the data that's embedded in that barcode then goes into our computer systems. We upgraded our interactive voice response system that we use in our call center so taxpayers can get information they need even if they can't talk to someone personally. We've been working on one of the biggest challenges that we faced in a long time in the income tax programs, the use of abusive tax shelters by some taxpayers, working with trying to do some prevention as well as detection and correction of those activities. Another success that we've seen over the years is continuing increases in the number of people who file their income tax returns electronically. And the last processing season, our season runs from January to June each year, we tipped the scale so that more than half of the returns that came in were electronic. And it just makes a huge difference for our potential for productivity over time and really helped push us toward that paperless strategy over the next 6 years. We will continue to get some paper returns, and it will be a high volume, but as our business partner, the Internal Revenue Service, emphasizes electronic filing, we get the benefit of that as well. In the policy area, we've partnered with 4 other state agencies to implement a new definition of independent contractor. And for us, it affects who is subject to withholding and who needs to file their own estimated taxes.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Does this agree with or conflict with the IRS rules on independent contractors?
Mr. Chair, the rule is compatible with but not identical to the Internal Revenue Service rules. The development in our courts of definitions of who is a worker for workers' compensation purposes heavily influenced the legislature in defining independent contractors. So we've honored that history of court interpretation, and what we're trying to do is just make sure that we're really, really clear with employers and people in the workplace about how to decide whether they're a worker or whether they're independent.
Thank you.
Turning to page 10, I'm trying to give you some visuals now of the big big programs areas that we have and what our activities are. For our individual income tax and for our corporate tax, we're tied to the federal definitions of what constitutes income under the Internal Revenue Code, and we use a lot of similar business practices and administrative practices so that we're consistent, and taxpayers know if the rule is this for federal, it's very likely it's also the rule for state. So timing of payments, definitions, and the like are consistent. As I've already mentioned, we do a lot of outreach, education, and assistance for taxpayers. We process 1,700,000 individual income tax returns. We bank all the dollars through either electronic funds transfer. In fact, more than half of the income tax dollars that come in now come in through electronic funds transfer technology, although we still get lots of paper checks with those tax returns in April. We audit tax returns to make sure that they're correct and that taxpayers have reported the appropriate amount of tax liability, not too much and not too little. We collect liabilities that if folks report, I owe tax, and then they haven't made the payments, so we pursue collection. And then if people should be filing but are not, we pursue getting them to file and get into compliance. The dollars that come in from these two taxes all go into the general fund. We also have partnerships with other state agencies in what we call our combined payroll program, where an employer can file one report and make one payment for individual income tax withholding, unemployment insurance taxes, a workers' compensation assessment that's based on payroll, and if they're doing business either in the Portland area or in the Lane County area, they can even pay their local transit taxes, all using the same form and the same payment. And we work with individuals and businesses, small and large, on those two programs. Our work is funded completely out of the general fund for these programs. And then one of the things that we wanted to be sure that you know that we understand is that who we serve are the citizens who receive the services that are funded by these programs. So that's the purpose of the chart on page 11. And we actually very successfully use this information when we're working with folks who we need to get into the system. Either they haven't been filing or they haven't been paying. We say, well, did you know that more than half of your income tax dollars get into our education system, almost half of them even back right down into your local schools? People often don't know this, and it really has provided a motivator for a lot of our taxpayers. Turning to page 13, the tobacco taxes, cigarette taxes, and taxes on other kinds of tobacco products, we collect those as well. The cigarette tax is collected through the pre-sale of stamps that go on the top of the carton or the top of the package of cigarettes and indicate that the distributor who has distributed those cigarettes in the Oregon market has paid the tax. That's their receipt, and it shows on each pack. For other types of products, there's no indicator on the product that the tax has been paid. It's more of a, like the income tax, they file a quarterly report showing how much their sales were in Oregon, reporting the amount of the tax and paying it in that way. So we process those returns, bank the dollars, collect what needs to be collected, audit the returns from the other tobacco products distributors. And we also work with the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's Office and the State Police on the law enforcement side of tobacco taxes. This is an area where, over the years, because of the difference in tax rates across the country. Different states have different rates, and the growth in the rates of tax across the country. There's quite a bit of opportunity for illegal activity in selling in Oregon, either cigarettes that haven't been stamped at all, which no tax has been paid in Oregon, or they've come in from a low tax state and are being sold here, no tax paid to Oregon, or they've been manufactured somewhere offshore and are completely have counterfeit stamps on them and the tax has not been paid. So we don't have law enforcement staff on our payroll. We work together with the state police and the attorney general's office. They investigate based on tips and prosecute those who are violating the law. And that partnership's been in place since 2003. And there have been a few things that they've done that have really helped stabilize the flow of the tax, especially the cigarette tax revenues, because a lot of people have looked for other sources as the prices go up. They look for other sources for cigarettes. And for a while, the Internet was a real big market for untaxed cigarettes. And the attorneys general of all the states got together and convinced credit card companies and shippers not to work with Internet sellers because of the very high risk of them selling to either minors or not collecting the tax. So that partnership's been really, really helpful. Those tax dollars go several different places. We've listed those for you. And our business partners there are about 90 distributors of tobacco products, and there are over 7,000 retailers that we work with to make sure that these tax laws are being complied with. The source of funding for this program is the tax revenue stream itself. That decision was made in 2003, and there's a sunset on it, and the legislature needs to consider whether to continue that funding stream for tobacco compliance during this legislative session. Turning to page 14 and 15, this is a very high-level overview of the property tax system. The property tax system fundamentally is administered locally by county assessors and county tax collectors. We support that system through some very specific functions that are paid for out of the general fund. We do valuation of complicated properties. So industrial plants where the value is $1 million or more, that would be manufacturing operations, high-tech manufacturers, food processing plants, wood processing, chemical industry, any other kind of manufacturing operation. And then we also do valuation for what we call centrally assessed properties, and that would be communications companies, transportation companies, and energy-related utilities. Those kinds of properties, the business is doing business all over the state or in many states, and it's very, very difficult for a county to figure out what the value of the portion that might be in their local area is for that whole enterprise of property. So we do the valuation and then certify to the counties the values. We also are responsible for making sure that the base maps that our property tax system relies on are accurate. So we develop standards that the maps at the local level need to meet. And we have contracts with 14 of the counties to actually do their map maintenance so that they don't have to maintain staff in order to do that themselves. We have a special project we've been working on since 1999 to develop a statewide digital map base that can support not only the property tax system, but other kinds of systems that need geospatial information data. And we're about 75% of the way to the goal of that statewide map base being completely digital and being able to support applications such as planning, emergency services management, natural resources management and monitoring. I think there were 60 layers the last time somebody showed me. And we have invited you all to join us over at the department on the first day of our regular hearings we'll be taking you through our processing center, but we'll also show you that mapping operation so that you can see the potential that that has to support a lot of government function. We are responsible for making sure that the property tax system is operated uniformly across the state in compliance with a constitutional requirement. And so we provide training, standards, and then special expertise in areas like farm use, forest, special exemptions that are available or special assessments that are available to support the county application of those laws. We're also responsible for overall determination of forest land values across the state. And the services that are paid for with the property tax dollars are pointed out for you on page 15. That's something that there's been a pretty strong tie because the schools get a lot of dollars from the property tax system and then look to the state for the rest of their funding. So it's important for this system to be healthy in order for the schools to be healthy. The last two pages just gives you a little flavor of the rest of the mix of what we do. The income tax, property tax, and tobacco taxes are the majority of our work, but we also administer other taxes for the state. Most of them, our administrative costs are paid out of the stream of revenue that we collect. We also provide collection services for other state agencies and for the courts and for, as I mentioned, TriMet and the Lane Transit District under contract. And we manage for you two assistance programs. One is a payment program that is funded through a legislative appropriation to very low-income elderly people to help them with their rent, and those payments go out in the fall of each year. And we also administer a deferral, tax deferral program. It's a revolving loan program, basically, that a qualifying individual, there are income limits and age limits, can apply to have their property taxes or local assessments for, like, lighting or sidewalks deferred, and the state pays them and has a lien against the property. And then when the property is sold or the individual decides to go ahead and pay the loan off, or if they die, then the amount that's been advanced by the state is paid back. Currently, the program is not only self-supporting, but it's generating more dollars than are needed to pay the taxes that we're currently paying for folks, and the excess is going into Oregon property. So that's a very high-level overview of what we do. I'm looking forward to visiting with you probably 6-8 weeks from now. If there are any questions that you have that you'd like us to focus on when we come back, either let Dallas know or let me know, and we'll be sure to include that in our presentation in chief.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today. And my question centers around performance measures. Do you have performance measures that you track specifically with regard to customer service? It occurs to me that for many Oregonians, their one interaction with state government on an annual basis, or at least their one interaction that they're very cognizant of, is going to be filling out that tax return. And you mentioned earlier that you have a system where you can receive emailed questions and then respond to them. So do you track, you know, the timeliness of your at the average timeliness of getting back to folks, and just an assortment of performance measures specifically relating to customer service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, we have one key performance measure related to customer service that parallels one that's used by all state agencies. We also do keep track of our call volumes, how long it takes for us to answer calls, how many calls end up being dropped because we've got a surge that we're not able to handle. We keep track of contacts to our email system, our questions, and our website usage. So we try and track how well the things that we're offering are being used. And then if we get any complaints or expressions of concern, we'll track back and see what's going on for the individual taxpayer. But that's sort of the waterfront in terms of the
follow-up.
So you track these measures. Do you actively manage to them? Do you say, well, our dropped call rate is X, and we're trying to get it here. What do we need to do to? Or is it just something that you kind of have there so that if anything comes up, you notice it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I mentioned one of the things that we did was upgrade our interactive voice response system. We did that partly because we know we can't answer all the phone calls. And so to give people more options so that we have fewer of those drop calls. One of the things that we've had a lot of telephone calls about over the last number of years is, where is my refund? I filed my return. I want to know where my refund is. And so we created a, not only in the interactive telephone system, but also on the Internet, now people can ask that question. And so the call volume on that issue now has been spread over more mediums, and people are able to get their answer more quickly. So what we try to do is keep track of what is it that our taxpayers are asking for, and then giving them those services. And the call volumes of the drop calls, and really what kinds of calls are we getting, helps us to be responsive now.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Senator Jones.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Last night in the land use fairness meeting, we heard that there are a number of counties that are either unwilling or unable to participate in the GIS system. And I recall last session you providing a tour for some of us that had the privilege of serving on this committee, and we saw the mapping and the GIS work that you were doing. I don't need an answer now, but it sure would be great to know what's the level of county participation and what are the bars to having all 36 counties fully participatory.
Okay. That is also a question, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that's also a question you might want to ask the Department of Administrative Services, because there are two ways in which counties connect with the state using geospatial information systems. One is the property tax map project that we're working on, and we have a very high level of engagement by all the counties in that effort. The other is a much broader set of activities and interactions and information sharing that's being coordinated through the Department of Administrative Services and through the Enterprise Information Services Division. They just changed the name. But that question may, or that comment may have come from, may have been about that broader participation, that some of the requests that are in the agreements that counties are being asked to sign have to do with data exchange and what information flows which way. And there, I think what I've heard is there have been some reservations about their ability to do that, or there's some public records overlays or something. So Department of Administrative Services may have some information on that as well.
Thanks.
Okay. With that, we are going to adjourn for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're adjourned.